This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Together we enter a virtual room and get briefed on the big questions of the moment by people who know some of the answers. If it helps you, or if it doesn't, or if there's anything we should be doing that we're not, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And many thanks to Kitley No Matt and Laser ASDF who have done just that. This week we're asking fees, debt and university funding. Is the student finance system working? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. Next week, exam results are published, and for millions of young people in England and Wales, the next step along life's primrose path will be university. In homes across the country, families are preparing to pop the Prosecco and then to try and work out just who pays for young Poppy and Alfie to go to college. This is not just a matter of confusion, it's also a matter of fierce contention. Labour now wants to abolish tuition fees altogether and reinstitute a system of student grants, and other critics point at high interest rates, the system's complexity, and the problem of the state ever getting its money back. So, is the system of student finance broken? And if so, what are the alternatives? Join me in the briefing room to find out. In the 1950s, only a very few young people went into higher education. Today, almost half do. So how did this big change come about, and where did the funding come from, both for students and the institutions they attend? Dr. Helen Carasso, lecturer in higher education at the University of Oxford, takes us on a time trip through university expansion.
In the period for about 15 years after the Second World War, just a tiny percentage of young people went to university, no more than 5%. Funding for students was arranged through local authorities, so depending on where you lived meant that the amount of money that you could get to support your studies would vary. Universities offered scholarships, different schemes too. The system was unpredictable for individual students. They didn't know readily how much they were going to get to support their studies, depending on where they went. And there was no set pattern for what a particular student would get because it varied depending on where they lived too. In the early 60s, we were starting to get to the point where there was going to be a bit of a demographic bulge. There were going to be more young people coming into the age where they would be potentially eligible for higher education. At the same time, we were moving towards more technologically based industries which needed a more skilled workforce. So these two reasons were drivers to think about the provision of higher education and what the country needed. The government set up the Anderson Committee, which looked at the way that funding should be arranged for individual students. It felt that the current model, which was variable depending on where you lived, really wasn't fair or consistent or sustainable, and moved towards a national funding model in which students would be means tested and would get support for their living costs depending on how much their family earned. So the richest students wouldn't get any support, the poorer students would get money to cover their costs at university. the year after the Anderson Committee in 1963, the Robbins Report was published. That was really a macroeconomic look at the higher education system, how many universities we'd got, how the teaching was funded, was it sustainable, did universities have enough money to deliver quality of teaching to the students they had, and were there enough places at university to support the demand from students, but also the needs of the country. One of the most famous things that came out of the Robbins Report was the so-called Robbins Principle, that higher education should be available to all those who had the ability to benefit from it. The Robbins Report looked at the question of whether students should be expected to take out loans to cover their university education, but they said they really didn't think that was right or fair, that it would saddle young people with a debt at the start of their careers, and they recommended continuing the idea of the grants that had been proposed by Anderson. Policies had what was really their desired effect. More people went to university. So 20 years after the Robbins Report, something like twice as many people from the 18 to 30 age group were going to university as had been before. However, it was becoming quite expensive for the government. And this was at a time when there were a number of pressures on the public purse, inflation was high. And so the government was beginning to think it couldn't afford to keep funding individual students in the way that it had done. So in 1990, they said they were going to stop increasing the amount of grant that was available to people from the poorest families, and that instead they were going to top that up with a loan that was going to be available. During the 90s, the pressure on public spending continued, and the amount of money that the government decided to give to universities for the teaching of each student didn't go up, according to the vice-chancellors at least, in line with the true costs of teaching those students. They were trying to teach each student with a smaller amount of money. There was pressure, therefore, to look at other ways to put money into supporting the teaching costs. So in 1998, the government introduced the first means-tested tuition fee of up to £1,000. At the same time, they decided to abolish grants completely. And so to make sure that money was available to support students, the next thing they, of course, had to do was increase the amount of student loan that was available.
Ask me my three main priorities for government, and I tell you, education, education, and education.
More people were going to university, and of course Tony Blair in his election campaign in 1997 said that he wanted 50% of young people to be able to go to university. That meant there had to be more places and more funding for places. So the next big change was to increase the tuition fee that was available for universities to charge. So from 2006 it was possible for universities to charge up to £3,000 in tuition fees. The trouble with the maximum fee of £3,000 was that it wasn't covering the full cost of the teaching of each individual student. The government was still putting a teaching grant into universities to cover the difference. So as the number of people started to go up again, in line with the aspiration to get 50% of young people into university, the costs of the public purse were going up. And of course it's attractive to the government to move those costs to the students who they would argue benefit from the higher education they're having. So in 2010, they announced that they were going to put the maximum fee level up from £3,000 to £9,000. And that caused quite a lot of pretty violent protests, and I think the government was surprised by what they saw.
No bus, no education cut! Free education! Now!
Helen Carasso and protesting students circa 2010. They lost, the £9,000 fees came in. Why that figure, and what happened next? In the briefing room now is Nick Hillman. He used to be a special advisor at the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, and he's now director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Nick Hillman, what was the rationale behind the big shift in tuition fees in 2012?
When the coalition government came to power back in 2010, it felt it had been elected on a commitment to reduce the deficit. And so universities were in the firing line. And we were desperate not to cut the number of student places, which would have been one way to save money. And we were also desperate not to cut the amount of money spent on each student. So we felt the only thing to do was to increase tuition fees. And Tony Blair had left the mechanism in place for us to do that because fees already existed. And the Brown Review, which had been put in place by Peter Mandelson in Gordon Brown's final years, delivered a report to us saying an increase in tuition fees was the right thing to do. So that's what we did.
Why was the fee set at £9,000 in England and Wales?
The independent Brown Review made a recommendation there should be no fee cap at all. So in other words, universities could charge any fee they wanted. We felt having no fee cap at all was a step too far. So we then had to decide what level should the fee go to. And universities said to us, look, we currently get about 6,500 from the old £3,000 fee and then the government grant to run the cheaper courses. Now, £6,500 is a lot less than £9,000. But at the same time as the higher fees coming in, other changes happened. So, for example, universities were told they'd have far less in the way of capital grants to build new buildings. And we also expected, wrongly, as it turned out, that not everybody would charge £9,000, but nearly every university went almost immediately for £9,000.
When it became obvious that the £9,000 fee was going to be the norm, did you anticipate that numbers would go up or down?
We hoped that student numbers would at least stay the same and in the medium to long term continue to increase. We knew that when Blair had tripled tuition fees, there'd been a one-year blip in applicants, but it had quickly recovered. And that is exactly what happened in 2012 as well. What we got wrong was what would happen to part-time student numbers. When we tripled fees, we also did a big increase in the fees for part-time students. But we said, don't worry, because you'll be entitled to loans the same as full-time students for the first time ever. But it turns out part-time students are very different to full-time students. You know, they might be holding down a job alongside their study. They may have big caring responsibilities. And the biggest problem was there's been a very significant drop in part-time student numbers since 2012.
Let's talk briefly about the different funding in different devolved parts of the United Kingdom, because not everybody has gone down this route in the United Kingdom.
Yes, and Scotland is the biggest outlier. So in Scotland, a Scottish student, or indeed a student from anywhere in the EU, though not from other parts of the UK, can go to university for free. There are consequences from not having high tuition fees. The first thing most Scottish vice chancellors will tell you when you meet them is how much richer their university would be if it was over the border in England. And they do maintain number controls in Scotland. So it's likely to be the case that it will be easier for an English student now to get into a Scottish university than a Scottish student, because the English student does pay fees. Wales has tuition fees, and they've just increased them actually to somewhere very close to the English level. But they have more generous maintenance support alongside. So everybody in Wales is going to be entitled to a maintenance grant. And we've abolished maintenance grants altogether in England for everybody. So there are different systems across the UK and they've been diversifying over the years.
OK, now let's talk a bit about how this is actually done. In the example of the English system, where exactly does the money come from that funds students, and who ultimately pays what and who gets what in the end?
So the government borrows the money on the markets, gives it to the student loan company, and the students apply to the student loans company. They tell the student loans company, I'm doing history at Manchester. The fee is, you know, £9,250. It goes directly from the government to the student loans company to the university. Obviously, living cost support is different. That does appear in the student's bank account. And then after graduating, it's the April after graduating. So people who graduated this summer, next April, April 2019, will have to start repaying their loans. And what happens is they pay 9% of their salary above £25,000. So it's like a bit of extra income tax on top of the income tax you pay. And one of the controversial bits of the system is the interest rate that's applied. So while you're studying, interest accrues on your loan at RPI, the Retail Prices Index, plus 3%. So from this September, that's 6.3%. So it's a high interest rate. Government has rejected the use of the Retail Prices Index as a measure of inflation for most things. The Office for National Statistics says it's a very bad measure of inflation and shouldn't be used for any public policy. But that is what is used for student loans.
Now, who owns that debt at the moment? What's happened to the loan book?
Well, the student loan book, which is enormous, it's more than £100 billion currently, largely just exists on the government's books. However, the government likes to sell the student loan book if and when it can, because it's exchanging future repayments from graduates for lots of cash in hand now. The last sale was at the very end of last year, which raised £1.7 billion. And the government would like to sell more of it off.
And who bought it?
Different people, actually. But the sort of people who are most likely to be interested in it are people like big pension funds, big financial houses, who want a secure asset. Because they're obviously giving a lot of money to government to buy the loan book. But in return, they're getting a flow of income from graduates repaying their loans year after year after year.
Nick Hillman. Earlier this year, almost unnoticed, the government launched a review of post-18 education, not just universities, but all of it. What should the review be considering when it comes to student finance? Joining me in the briefing room to discuss this are Lorraine Dearden, Professor of Economics and Statistics at University College London and a researcher at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and Nicholas Barr, Professor of Public Economics at the London School of Economics. Professor Barr, if I can start with you. Looking at the current system of student financing, what would you say the biggest problems were?
The key root problem is a technical one, namely the way student loans appear in the public accounts. The way it's done artificially reduces the government deficit now when students are borrowing a lot of money. And the non-repayment by students doesn't hit the government accounts for 30 years. So this gives an incentive to increase tuition fees and to increase interest rates, which increases apparent government income now and flatters the deficit. And it's that accounting problem that drives higher fees, higher interest rates, the incentive to three-year full-time degrees rather than more flexible forms of post-school study.
How does it work that the operation of this accounting system actually makes for higher fees?
What appears as government income this year is the interest that current and past borrowers owe this year, not what they actually pay, what they owe. The larger the fee, the larger the loan. The higher the interest rate, the higher the notional interest payments. So high fees and high interest rates create a bigger gain to the budget deficit than lower fees and lower interest rates. And that was what was one of the big drivers of the 2010 reforms.
Professor Dearden, what do you think the biggest problems with the current system of student financing are?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems with the current system, it was the abolition of grants in 2016, whereby now the students with the biggest loans are those coming from the poorest backgrounds. And once again, this policy was driven by government accounting rules. Grants count towards the budget deficit, loans don't. You know, the upfront cost of having loans rather than grants saves the government a lot of money, but the long-run savings are very small, only about £360 million.
Now, these were not grants that were given to all students. These were specifically maintenance grants given to the poorest students and that were replaced by loans.
Loans, that's right. And we have really robust evidence that grants matter for the participation of low-income students. In 2005, nothing in the system changed except grants were reintroduced. Everything else remained the same, and there was a significant increase in the participation of those coming from the poorest background.
Now, that was in 2005 when the then Labour government introduced top-up fees.
No, the top-up fees came a year later. Grants came a year earlier.
But it was part of the same political package, wasn't it, that they essentially, in order to sell the tuition fees, they had to reintroduce the grants. And you're saying that as a consequence of that, there was a very big uptick in participation rates among poorer students, which subsequently fell off because the grants were taken away.
Well, the grants weren't taken away till 2 years ago. We haven't seen the impact yet. We haven't got the figures. But I will bet my house that it will have impacted on the participation of the poorest children.
Make that two houses. Yeah. So in other words, the tuition fees themselves won't have impacted upon the participation rate of poorer students, but the abolition of the grants, you think, will prove to have impacted significantly. Looking at the situation more widely for the British economy and British society, do you think the current system provides us with the right sorts of skills for the country's economy and its labour market? Professor Barr.
The driver is towards university degrees. Higher education is funded separately from technical and the rest of further education, and higher education is funded more generously. And you can't start off doing a technical qualification and build it into a degree. So the problem is you've got separate silos for university education and the rest of tertiary education. The technical side of things is under-resourced and there's insufficient flexibility. An economy needs both and ideally needs a way where young people can, for example, get a plumbing qualification, have the finance to do it, and then if he or she wants to turn that into a degree at a later stage, can do so by adding academic credits later.
OK, let's look at other countries and other potential models which might be regarded as superior. Essentially, how do they do things in other places that we might learn from and emulate, Professor Dearden?
A country like Australia is an interesting case. They have an income contingent loan which applies across the whole post-18 sector.
So they do technical education
as well? They do technical education as well. Interestingly, they have much more controls over the courses which they fund. And unlike the UK, there is a mixture of funding from direct government grants for courses and fees. So they have four different fee levels, a high fee level, you know, down to a low fee level. And then they also get, universities get government grants from the government. And so something like a high cost course like nursing gets a large government grant but has low fees.
Now, I can imagine straight away the objection that all kinds of bits of the university system would have to that. The government wouldn't want to fund arty-farty courses, it wouldn't want to fund some of the more kind of creative courses, it wouldn't want to fund some of the courses that universities have put on.
But that's in effect what it's done in the 2012 reforms. The biggest increases in funding, 40% increase, has been for arts and humanities because of the changes. The smallest increase has been for the science subjects, a 6% increase, because everybody charges £9,000 fees, but the changes in funding means that it now pays universities much more, they get much more than they did before for the arts and humanities rather than science.
Sorry, Professor Barr, that's very counterintuitive. Is that because these arts courses cost less to put on than these other scientific courses, that a lot of students want to do them and therefore they can effectively, these institutions make a lot of money simply by putting on these sorts of courses?
I mean, the so-called chalk and talk subjects, where essentially you've got an academic and a PowerPoint projector, are obviously much cheaper than science courses where you need laboratories and technical equipment and things like that. There is additional taxpayer support for science degrees, but it's still the case that the cheaper subjects are more generously funded.
So something like the Australian system has the government charging straight in and saying, well, actually, we're not going to do it that way. We're actually going to make sure that the funding goes to the kinds of courses we want.
But it's actually a mixture. It's actually targeted at some of the courses that the government wants, but also high demand, well-paying jobs like law and economics get virtually no government subsidy and charge the highest fees. So it's a mixture of both demand and supply.
At the last election, Labour went into the election with the promise of getting rid of student tuition fees altogether, reintroducing grants for all students and so on. And in the manifesto, it said, like they do in southern Northern European countries. Professor Barr, is a Northern European model sustainable in a British context?
Let me try and unpack it. there's models with fees and models without fees. Models without fees can come with well-financed universities or with poorly financed universities. The Nordic countries have a political economy settlement where people, the electorate, is prepared to vote for higher taxes in order to have high-quality public services, and that works for them. In the rest of Europe, where they don't have tuition fees, it's not generously financed, so there the worry is quality, sort of 800 students in a lecture hall, huge dropouts at the end of the first year. So if you don't have fees, either you have to spend a lot of taxpayer money on it, or you've got quality problems. If you do have fees, there's a good way of doing it, which is you cover them by loans with income-related repayments, and there's a terrible way of doing it, which is charging upfront fees without a loan.
Professor Dearden, is that broadly how you see it?
That's how I see it. And interestingly, what you have seen since the introductions of fees and loans in England in 1998... the biggest proportionate increase in participation has been from low-income students. And that is because when you have free higher education, places are capped, and the people who missed out tended to be those coming from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds, and they have seen the biggest increase since this because it is free at the point of access for them, because they have generous upfront support for both the fees are paid and loans. How you pay it just depends on how well you do in the labour market. And also, it has expanded the number of well-funded places at university.
Professor Bart, what about in the current system, the participation rate from part-time students and people who go in at a non-standard way?
It pays universities more to have three-year full-time students. There's a built-in escalator. It's like an executive lift that goes straight from level 3 to level 6 without stopping at levels 4 and 5, the technical qualifications in between.
So what's happened to part-time education since 2012?
So what's happened to part-time education is that part-time students, some of them are eligible for fees loans, but not for maintenance loans. If fees go from 3,000 to 9,000, that is, for part-time students, proportionately a much bigger increase, which is why demand has dropped and why, since universities have no incentive to teach part-time, supply has dropped. So the catastrophic decline in part-time education, which is hugely important both for reasons of economic growth and for reasons of widening participation, is a direct consequence of the funding mechanism.
What I'm getting from both of you is the idea that essentially a tuition fees-based system is going to be the basis of any English and Welsh system and so on, but that we need to make critical alterations to it. So let's examine what those are. So you're in government, you both have the capacity to make that change tomorrow for next year. What will they be?
One, introduce a system of transferable academic credit for which the fee is related to how much credit you get, so that a student can do some courses at an institution and then move on. And the second thing would be to design funding and student support so that it covers the whole of post-18 education.
So that would not just be university, but also technical education.
Yes.
As well.
Part of the problem is it's so complicated to understand. I mean, I don't think students understand the system. What does having RPI plus 3.5% interest rate whilst you're at college mean? I think that, you know, the headlines we saw last May when students were stunned, you know, that their bill had gone up by, you know, on average by £6,000 was because they just didn't understand the system. It's got to be transparent and clear.
Lorraine Dearden and Nicholas Barn, what I take away from what the two of you have been saying is that this binary discussion we always have between fees and no fees is really not that helpful. And we'd do a lot better to look at what we want to achieve more widely in post-18 education and training and how we're going to fund it. Well, that's it for this week. My thanks to Helen Carasso, Nick Hillman, to Lorraine Dearden and Nicholas Barr. We'll be back next Thursday. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The producers were Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling, Olivia Beasley and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series, and you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We appreciate hearing from you.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.